But I don't think Monroe did any of that.
No.
That's why I would say like a three. Like, not bad. I don't want to be disrespectful, but it's
below. What was his party again?
The Democratic Republican Party.
Okay, so he wasn't with the Federalists.
No. What a long name, by the way. Democratic Republicans. Like, geez, come on, guys.
No wonder why they split in two.
That's not how we got
them. Oh, it's not? Oh. All right, welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the smoot to Eric's Holly, and boy, do we have a great idea for today. Well, last time we finished up, I know we talked about Monroe, but honestly, I cannot remember what we actually discussed in the last episode.
That James Monroe would beat... No, that's been our overarching theme, that James Monroe beat you up.
I know he got... Shot in the shoulder. Somebody had to pinch the artery shut.
Yeah, Dr. Riker.
Denmark Vesey was Tony Stark. And what was the other thing we learned?
Oh, he had...
Monroeville.
Monroeville, the capital of Liberia, that he also had the most stacked cabinet of all time, both in names
and
in talent.
That's right.
That John Adams and Crawford wouldn't talk to each other, so James Monroe was happy to go between. He's a quiet man. He was a Calvin Coolidge before Calvin Coolidge. He oversaw a fairly prosperous return to normalcy after the falling of the Second National Bank. But now we're going to talk about the thing he's most known for.
The Monroe Doctrine.
The Monroe Doctrine.
He didn't write it? Wait. He
did not write it.
Hold on. Before we do that, I'm going to give you a choice here. Do we want to continue with the mispronunciation bit, or do you want to try a new one?
Absolutely. Somebody commented on the Canadian video.
That was the new segment I was going to introduce called "You Got Some Splainin' to Do."
You got some splainin' to do. I don't want to open that Pandora's box. It's important to remember we don't cover everything thoroughly. That would take years and years and years. So I will be willing to do a 3-year. Show on John Quincy Adams. I just want to let you know that I'm open to doing that.
With John Quincy Adams, this is going to be the end of this era, so we're actually really close to getting out of this. And I kind of want to do some recap episodes with you too after we get through that.
Oh, we should do. If you ever, this is probably a very, very famous YouTube channel called Extra Credit, and they do a history podcast. And on their podcast, every time they end a segment, like a compilation of videos on one topic. Mm-hmm. They do a What We Got Wrong. It's amazing. It's just like, it could not be A, better produced, and B, more like self-deprecating for such an intelligent group of people. To be like, yeah, no, we got that wrong. I don't know what you want from us. I hate any show that tries to think it's 100% right.
Oh, God, I know. I think you're supposed to be wrong a bunch. That way you get people angry enough to comment, because otherwise, otherwise they don't want to.
Kyle's like, new business strategy, rage bait.
Right. Okay, let me. I just got to see if I can get to these comments.
So I get the comments here.
Okay. All right. You got the comments.
Yeah, see? Because I come prepared. I'm joking. All right. So the first comment is, it was the British who marched on the White House under Robert Ross, who was killed at Baltimore. The regiment involved were the Essex Regiment, the Scottish Fusiliers, the King's Own Lancaster. Lancashire Regiment, the Bucks Regiment, kudos us, that's our regiment if we had to pick one, and the Kings, these sound like made up name, Shropshire Light Infantry, but infantry spelled with an E.
You're not picking fights with their commenters, are you?
No, I'm learning, and I like to learn, but I also accept I can't pronounce anything. And then you go, we tried to argue that Canada wasn't a country yet. Your argument is much more compelling. And then the guy responds, perhaps I was being a tad pedantic. Honestly, I am super big fan of anybody who uses the word tad.
I'm a super fan of pedantic.
I'm actually a huge fan of this dude.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy's 100% right. He's a 1,000,000% right. Just to let everybody know, our fourth show or our last show in a series is usually just like... us being kind of goofy and conjecture. I mean, everything we talked about there actually happened, but we obviously know Canada wasn't a country yet. Like, we're very aware Canada wouldn't become a country for over another 100 years. It is funny because did we ever say that Joel? Oh, no, in the clip, we don't show it. But Joel
does point out, that the Canadian independence happened, I think, like 50 years after this event happened.
Yeah. Like, we're all aware of that. Like, that's the joke. is that obviously the Canadians didn't do it. But so, it's funny to blame them for.
So maybe I shouldn't have made a short out of that, is really what this is coming down to.
Hey, it got engagements. I must watch one.
It did, right?
And then the second guy who commented. Oh, sorry.
He was actually the first. Yeah.
Second. The second guy was like General Robert Ross, a general in the British Army. It was the British who burned down the White House. We tried to, and then you responded, we tried to argue that too, but Eric shut us down. I just want to comment something. If we're going to be pedantic here, it was a presidential mansion. It didn't become the White House after it was rebuilt.
Oh. So they didn't even burn down the White House.
No, it was called the Presidential Mansion at the time. Which, if he had watched the full episode, I made a comment about that. But yes, we do know the Canadians did not burn down the White House. It was the Brits. We totally get that. I got to say, this is going to sound really funny, but I love the commenters who are like, no, it was Robert Ross. It was all this stuff. I think we talked about Robert Ross in that episode or a different episode. But I mean, like, that's the fun of it. Like, this isn't a formal history class.
That's why I brought it up here, too, because nobody was coming at us like, oh, you guys are a bunch of idiots. You got it all wrong. Like, no, everyone was, it looked like it was just someone trying to share some knowledge and have fun with it.
Which is like, we want more of that.
Yes.
Like,
please.
I love, like, dude, how often in your life do you get to bring up, like, Robert Ross? Like, right? I love the fact there's people out there who, like, know this stuff and will take time to actually comment on it. That's awesome. That's how you do that. I mean, like, and especially, dude, the first guy, I love that he walked through all of those. Like, who was there? Like, yeah. I'm like that, too.
I was thinking we should have got him on this show. Does he want to come on?
Honestly, Michael.
He could replace me for an episode.
No, replace me for an episode? That'd be sick. We want to hear comments like that. That's a positive thing.
Yep. All right. And then I guess the last week's mispronounced word was either emphasizing. I think you tried to pronounce it emphasizing. Yes. It was either that one or desire T, I think I've written down here, also counts too.
I like the emphasize.
All right. So should we actually talk about some Monroe Doctrine?
Yeah, sure. Let's get on. Let's get going. All right. The Monroe Doctrine was probably the most important piece of legislation, foreign policy legislation, maybe in the history of the United States. It's definitely of the 1800s. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think what would be a bigger foreign policy doctrine. Maybe the Marshall Plan. Maybe the Marshall Plan would be a bigger one. So broadly, what it says is that that Europeans are going to stay out of the Americas.
Was it just Europeans, or was it basically any foreign power basically saying there will be no colonialism here in the Americas?
That's a good question. So it was specifically directed at the Europeans because at this point, you still have like the colonial actions of a lot of countries in Asia. They're just not expeditionary. Like they're not coming across.
They weren't carving up pieces of Africa amongst themselves.
No, they were carving up pieces of Southeast Asia for themselves. This is also primarily to combat Russia also.
Russia's a funny one, though. Does Russia count as a European power, or is it an Asian power?
So normally Russia's considered its own thing.
Right.
But at this point, they are considered a European power. So if we go through what's in the actual Monroe Doctrine. Now, I want to say something. So we made a joke early on about James Monroe didn't write, not a joke, it's a factual thing, that James Monroe didn't write the Monroe Doctrine. That's a very well-known historical fact today.
Mm-hmm.
John Quincy Adams never discussed his role in the Monroe Doctrine.
Oh, so he never actually got credit during his time.
Yep. It was an open secret in D.C. that John Quincy Adams wrote it. But John Quincy Adams refused to take credit for it because he said it is the president, not his cabinet, that is the seat of policy. This is something we'll talk about in the John Quincy Adams episodes, but John Quincy Adams is largely credited with the founding of the idea of public service in the United States. The idea of people who professionally work in government using skills I would probably, more commonly see in the private sector and serving in government. And so he believed that there was no separation between what somebody as a cabinet does and what the president does. His whole logic was the president appointed me to the role of Secretary of State. I did what he appointed me to do. It's his, he did this. This is him.
Did I hear this wrong? Because I remember Thomas Jefferson. I think I saw somewhere that he tried to take credit for like all of the Declaration of Independence.
That sounds like Jefferson. Yeah, he was very angry when they were like changing parts of it. But they were like, yo, Jefferson, you wrote saying that you don't believe in slavery and I've been to your farm.
I'm just pointing out, you got one president here who's trying to take credit for everything. And then you got another guy who's taking credit for nothing.
You have one president who owned other people.
But he did do that.
Not owning other people. And then you have another president who famously was an abolitionist, broke the gag rule when he became a rep, and famously defended the Mende people, arguing, and I'm just going to blow people's mind, that humans aren't cargo against the Spanish. I can imagine the Spanish have a monument to John Adams in their country. I guarantee they probably don't want a monument to John Quincy Adams, because a big reason the Monroe Doctrine was written was to counter Spanish aggression in the South Americans. And he defended the Mende people who were like on a Spanish slave trading ship. And he was like, yo, what are you guys doing here? I think that might be episode.
Wait, John Quincy Adams did this?
John Quincy Adams, yeah.
Oh, so like he was following his father's footsteps, because his dad was the one who defended the people from the Boston Massacre.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, these moral and upstanding people who didn't own other people were morally and moral upstanding characters, and they only got one term.
Right.
They only got one term. Like, that's crazy. Is that crazy? Yeah. Like
just start a new movement. If you only good presidents get one term.
One of my favorite random presidential facts: the average presidential length of somebody from Massachusetts is less than 1 year, or less than one term.
Less than one term, yeah, because of Kennedy.
Yeah, my microphone just fell. Yeah, because of Kennedy. Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. Three of the four are all from the same county. Oh, random presidential trivia, since we will take us literally a couple of years to get to George H.W. Bush, is that was the only presidential election where both candidates were born in the same county.
Wait, no.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Michael Dukakis and George H.W. Bush were both born in Norfolk County.
Really?
Yeah. There's a random That's presidential wild. Fact. Huh. Which is funny to think those two people are born in the same state. That way. So the Monroe Doctrine, it was written by John Quincy Adams, but make no mistake that they didn't know that during that time. Well, it was kind of an open secret among the Washington elites and anybody who would be influential in politics too. But it was seen as this kind of glowing endorsement of John Quincy Adams and it wasn't like he was like, oh no, I didn't do it. He was more like outright rejection of acknowledging it. He's like, well, you don't take credit for every letter somebody wrote that James Madison used.
Right.
So the Monroe Doctrine was first discussed in his seventh annual address to Congress. That's your State of the Union, by the way. They used to call them annual addresses. So this is his seventh. So this is December 2nd, 1823. And it was one of the foundational parts of his speech. And what's funny is the Monroe Doctrine actually originated from the British.
What?
Yeah, so this gentleman, George Canning, came to the United States in August of 1823. He was all right, so the history books call him a foreign secretary. And
okay.
I was trying to look that up. So sometimes you'll read historians refer to him as the British foreign secretary, which would be the Secretary of State in many cases. Okay. The problem with George Canning is he's like the most prolific diplomat of the 19th century, probably in the entire Western world, probably in the world itself. So he has many different titles. I like to use the term British Foreign Secretary because that's, in a rote sense, what it's referred to for the vast majority of this discussion. So I just want listeners to know that, like, you may read this and it may say British Foreign Secretary with a lowercase s. Same person, same time frame.
I think the only person who's going to care about that is the guy that we lost when we accused Canada of burning down the White House.
I honestly want him back on. I want him on the show. Because you probably just educate me on it.
Right.
So this is 1823. Canning reaches out to the British envoy, Stratford Canning, not related. And then Dick Rush, Richard Rush.
Love that name, yes.
Dick Rush. He's the American minister to Great Britain. In this time frame, we don't really use the term ambassador that much. It's mostly minister. And the reason is because ministers kind of have more authority than what like an ambassador would have. Because it takes so long for information to travel that ministers are given a good amount of authority. So George Canning proposed to Stratford Canning, hey, we should do this agreement that, you know, we don't have Europeans meddling in the Americas. So Stratford goes to, I'm going to start using the first names. Stratford, proposes this. Britain and the U.S. jointly declare this opposition to any European intervention in Latin America and commit to non-acquisition of former Spanish colonies. That's something that doesn't get talked about a lot, the Monroe Doctrine.
No. So we just kind of piled on board with the British, just trying to keep Spain out, basically.
Yeah. So at this point, Spain is just losing a ton of territory.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you remember, like, Spain had
self-control. Kind of claims the Louisiana territory that was sold out from under them. Yeah. Florida got kind of, like, snatched out from under them.
Yep. And at the same time, you know, we're kind of seeing this. I'm trying to think what's the best way to describe. So, like, we're starting to see this wave of revolutions, but, like, not revolutions like American revolutions. These are more like, you know, we had the salutary neglect in the United States, right? Like, the Brits left us alone for so long. We formed our own traditions. Our own economy became super powerful. And the Brits chose to fight us when we declared independence. Well, Britain was ultra powerful, this standpoint. It's crazy that we beat them.
Yeah, but I know.
Colombia, Argentina, Chile, Mexico, and Peru, among a slew of other nations, they were like, we're our own countries right now. And Spain didn't really have the ability to go take them back.
Put down a revolution, and, right.
Yeah, dude, right? Dude, 100% right. So throughout the early 1820s, we're seeing all these. And in particular, you had this country called Gran Colombia at the time that's like modern-day Venezuela, and this huge, I mean, I believe John Adams once said, like, this is going to be the U.S. of South America, but ended up splitting up into a lot of the countries you see in northern South America. And there was a fear that, you know, you would see Russia, France, maybe some other countries go in there and try and take them over. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these were republics that were modeled in the same way like America was, and in some cases France, but not really.
Like French Guiana,
which is still part of France. That is one of the best random facts, which the largest park in the EU is in South America.
That's a great fact.
So it was kind of like this post-Napoleonic War era. There was this movement among Britain, France, Russia, Prussia, and Austria. They formed this, you're probably familiar with the term, the Concert of Europe, which is all these monarchs that get together, and they're going to try and restore monarchs and suppress revolutions. But the Brits are incredibly savvy, and they're like, wait a minute. We're not going to be able, we just fought this massive war, right? We just had this wicked, we had a really, really bloody revolution. We had this horrific, essentially the first modern war, the Napoleonic War. What are we doing here, guys? So in 1823, there was rumors that France, possibly with the Spanish approval, might start military intervention in Latin America to help Spain reconquer the former colonies. And at the same time, Russia really started strongly asserting its claims to the Pacific Northwest coast. Mm-hmm. So in Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. So Adams, you know, because he's a secretary of state, this gets back to Adams. And he's like, he was actually kind of a fan of it right off the bat. But he said to Monroe, I want to give you a quote from Adams to Monroe. It would be more candid, as well as more dignified, to avow our principles explicitly to Russia and France than to come in as cockboat in the wake of the British man of war. And so basically he was saying, we're going to be in a little rowboat. They're going to be in a man of war. And this is the guy whose dad built all these giant ships to go crush people in the Caribbean. He's like, my dad knows what's up. And his dad's still alive at this time, which is kind of cool.
The Constitution says hi over there.
Yeah, right? The Constellation's actually fighting the slave trade, I think, at this time. They're doing other cool stuff. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, it's really interesting he says that. So it was actually focused on Russia and France, but it was Spanish. It was former Spanish colonies movements to independence that triggered it. So you can see all these different events are threading into the Monroe Doctrine.
It's funny, though. It doesn't look like we cared necessarily about letting them find their own way. We just cared that nobody else intervened but us.
Yeah, bizarrely, America's intentions to intervene in Latin America don't really form until after the 1940s, believe it or not. So the Monroe Doctrine breaks into four different parts. I mean, it's obviously much longer. It's part of a State of the Union address, but we're not going to go through the entire speech.
You don't want to read the whole thing off?
Can I do it in my Boston accent?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Jim Monroe here. Hey, kid. does he smoke out of Marlboro Red as he's saying this? No, so the first one is non-colonialization.
If you're listening and you're wondering what next week's mispronounced word was going to be, I think we just found it.
Yeah, I can say colonialization. Yes. And I can say non, but non-colonialization feels better. Let me try and get this one.
Make sure you get them both together.
Yes. Non-colonialization. Got that one. You guys, how much easier the show would be if I didn't prepare for it whatsoever and just kind of made a little stuff up as I went along instead of trying to actually keep detailed notes.
I didn't. I thought that's what we were doing.
No. So, non-colonization.
Nope.
Non-colonialization.
There you go.
The direct quote for Kyle's gonna die.
Oh my god!
So the quote, the quote tied to that is naturally like the American continents are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization.
You're so close, so close.
Oh my god! All right. So what it really breaks down to, and directly from the Monroe Doctrine, is the American continents are now henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonization. Again, the old-timey English trying to get to that word is what's killing me. If we look directly at the Monroe Doctrine at the time, you know, what it explicitly said when it came to this was the American continents are henceforth not to be considered as subjects for future colonialization by any European power.
Yeah.
What does that mean? So it means no new European colonies were to be tolerated in the Western Hemisphere.
So the ones that
had one, you're fine.
Okay. So like Canada was fine. Russia's interests in Alaska were fine. Spain's.
Well, they didn't. Yeah, in Alaska. I'm sorry. Yes, you're correct there.
Yeah. Yeah. Not in Oregon.
In a lot of so the reason I said that is my next dude. It's like you're reading off my notes. That's crazy. So like. Historians actually say that line. A lot of people get taught that that line was directed at France and Spain, but it wasn't. It was directed at Russia, who was trying to claim the Oregon and Washington territory. And be honest with you, at this time, Russia wasn't exactly in a position to try and infringe on that. So I don't know if that was more like, hey, we see what you're doing. And the minute they felt friction, they were like, maybe we don't want to do this.
Who was in charge at the time?
Yeah.
Was that before Catherine the Great?
I think this is right after Catherine the Great. Alexander the First.
Oh.
Wow. Okay. So that was one of their big rulers.
Yeah.
Then Nicholas the First came after. Huh. No, more you know, Russian history. Huh. So that primary point that was aimed at Russia was saying no new colonies, but you got colonies, you can keep them.
Yeah.
The next major point was non-intervention. And, you know, to quote the part of the Monroe Doctrine on this, it's we owe it, therefore, to candor and to the amicable relations existing between the United States and those powers to declare that we should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and safety. That is the U.S. basically saying, like, if you come over here, we're going to view this as a national threat. That's really
the act of war, is what they're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it basically meant like European powers should not interfere with newly independent nations of Latin America. Mm-hmm. And here's where it gets weird. This is where it gets interesting. And this is where the Brits, the whole concert system becomes really interesting. The U.S. kind of extended this view of influence on the New World, not just as like you come over here and fight, you come in and try, you know, regain Chile under your control. They also basically said anybody who imposes a monarchical system, that would be viewed as hostile and basically a threat of, it would be an act of war to the U.S. If you were saying, do you want Chile, you can be your own country, but you're going to be under the Spanish crown. They would also view that as hostile.
Oh, so it was actually specifically monarchies that called out, not just any, I thought it was any form of government or whatever ideology that they were currently under.
Yeah, I often wonder, given how good of a diplomat that George Canning was, even though the Brits were very supportive of a monarch, I wonder if he was smart enough to know that, like, that's a good thing to include there. Like, because the Brits could be like, oh, I don't know. I didn't know the U.S. included that without sounding hypocritical.
Right.
It's kind of a cool move. We're all going to be monarchs. But if monarchs go over there, you're going to have to fight this new nation. That's economically really powerful by this point. So the third point was U.S. neutrality from European affairs. This tends to get glossed over, as Monroe said, as Adams wrote and Monroe said, it is only when our rights are invaded or seriously menaced that we resent injuries or make preparations for our defense. That's him kind of saying, like,
don't mess with us and we won't mess with you.
Bingo.
Yeah. You know,
the U.S. said it would not interfere in European politics or wars, and it really hadn't by this point, and expected the U.S. do the same in all of the Americas.
So is the Monroe Doctrine then what was being leaned on for the isolationist policies of World War One? Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Kyle, that's an excellent observation. You basically see 90 years of semi-isolationism.
Mm-hmm.
The American teenage years of us kind of figuring out who we were as a nation. We're largely void of European intervention on both sides. One last point of the Monroe Doctrine I want to bring up was the recognition of existing European colonies. Now, this is very important to the Europeans, that the U.S. not only said, no new colonies, we can keep your old ones, they then recognized it. And you know, what Monroe said was, with the existing colonies or dependencies of any European power, we have not interfered and shall not interfere. Mm-hmm. Meaning this doctrine wasn't applied retroactively. And that prospective attitude that the U.S. took actually made a lot of Europeans kind of like,
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, they were kind of like, oh, okay, this is interesting. But yeah, I mean, one of the more interesting parts is the U.S. populace was like, you know, if you look at some of the newspapers at the time, they were mostly happy.
Is there one behind me here?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Local cartoon. Yeah.
I think yours is the Venezuela border dispute, I want to cover, hot lap some of these, but the Venezuela border dispute is absolutely fascinating because it's actively being something discussed today. Oh. 2025.
Yeah, that's wild.
But just to cover public sentiment is that a lot of people approved of it, but people weren't like overly pumped. It's like at this point the era of good feeling's been going on for a while. Every kind of state of the union's the same. It's all this peace, prosperity, national unity. All the major editors in the major newspapers said like, hey, this is awesome. It's the Americans, exporting American independence and asserting a position globally. If you look at the Northeast, the commercial hubs, they liked it a lot because they liked trading.
Yeah.
Trading with them. The Southerners, they were hugely supportive of it because they thought it was awesome that you had this idea of national sovereignty and this ability of independent trade benefited the export-based region a lot. There was a little interpretation by slaveholders. Which, as by the way, that's a continuous thing. It's going to get more and more aggressive until we get to 1861. A lot of slaveholders were worried about how those revolutionary republicanism spreading from Latin America was run by non-whites. And they thought slaves would start getting this idea that they're humans and should be free. What a novel idea.
Was it Haiti or Barbados or one of those that overthrew and like, so, I mean, they're not wrong to be afraid.
Yeah.
They are wrong to be afraid, I guess, but they're on the wrong side of history, but their fears are legitimate.
Yeah, the Haiti Rebellion was the U.S. didn't want to acknowledge that for a long time because the Southerners were like, well, if you acknowledge that as a state, or as a nation, I should say, are you passively endorsing that slaves have the right to revolt?
Yeah.
Now, Kyle, this is where sometimes it freaks me out, some of the stuff you say, because I'm like, is he hacking my stuff? You brought up Manifest Destiny.
Yeah.
So Manifest Destiny didn't really get its name until like the 1830s, 1840s. A lot of Westerners would point to the Monroe Doctrine as this kind of like proto-justification for Manifest Destiny, and it fed into this already established narrative that the U.S. had a moral and territorial authority over pretty much all the Americas, but specifically what we'd call modern-day America.
Right.
If you're curious if the Federalists are still doing it at this point,
are there still Federalists at this point?
There are. And they are. It took me a long, I actually, there was one, I really, really just wanted to say their book, but it was just like a journal paper that I read. They kind of accepted defeat by this point. It pretty much all but collapsed. But here's the funny thing. The Monroe Doctrine may have been its last, what killed it, because the remaining members of the Federalist Party kind of unanimously supported the Monroe Doctrine.
Mm. You can't agree with your enemies.
Yeah, God forbid. I got to tell you, do you know who really loved this? What group of people really loved this?
The Monroe Doctrine?
Yeah.
Texas? I don't know.
Probably right. The Latin America thought this was insane. Oh,
they should. Yeah, this is free reign for them to go try to shake the yokels off and Shake off the yolks and try to do something new.
Like,
yeah.
Europe was like, okay, whatever, we really don't care. The Brits were like, nice, like, sweet, we kind of wanted this. American public was like, oh, cool, no, we like this. Not the biggest deal in the world. Latin America was like, this is awesome. So so I mentioned Gran Colombia earlier. That's Simón Bolívar. He's kind of considered like the modern day founding father of that era, but especially Venezuela, yeah, who calls their currency the Bolívar. They thought it was awesome, but they viewed it. So what they liked about it was that they knew this was unenforceable. The U.S. didn't have, the military might to support multiple independent movements and fight off Europe. It was more a warning shot, but they viewed it as something they had never had before, which is ideological solidarity.
Yeah.
That the United States, the first successful republic in the Western Hemisphere, very early in its lifespan, sent a warning to European monarchs not to interfere, not don't mess with Latin America. And it bolstered the legitimacy of these new republics. And, I kind of love it. It kind of really established that Americans are not Europeans.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously there was no military commitment to any of this. In retrospect, some historians have said, like, oh, was this genuinely supporting Republican freedom, or do they want exclusive, right to influence the Western Hemisphere? Two things can be true.
Let's be honest. Yeah, I mean, goodwill it has value. There's a reason why there's a line item on company, earning statements,
yeah,
or financial statements. I mean, yeah, you can do a nice thing for a country and get some benefit from it later that has real value.
So one of the things I want to do, Kyle, because I'd love to get your reaction to this, is I want to look for, like, I do want to end on the Venezuelan border dispute.
Okay.
But I want to take a few minutes and run through the history of Latin Americans' response to Monroe Doctrine, because it gets brought up a lot, actually, in speech.
Okay.
But I also want to do a history of how it's changed our viewpoint on Monroe Doctrine.
Okay.
I think it'd be pretty funny. All right. So, 1820s, right? Everybody's Latin America's cautiously optimistic. They value the symbolic support, but, they know the U.S. can't enforce it. By like the 1850s, they're starting to get a little skeptical because they're like, hey, U.S., you just took over Texas and Mexico.
Right, yeah.
And we start seeing this word going imperialist going around there. Latin America's like, what's going on here? Okay, so by the time Roosevelt comes into office, so I'm talking TDR, early 1900s, you had imperialism. You had, hey, cool, imperialism. So early 1900s, you could broadly discuss, describe Latin America as alarmed and angry, I guess would be the words.
That's a good way to say it, I suppose.
With the general sentiment where they viewed the U.S. intervention as a betrayal of republicanism.
That's harsh language. Okay.
Yeah, but it gets worse. So from about the 1950s to today, the sentiment by Latin Americans has been actually, and again, you're going to read different historians. This now gets into IR and to, international politics and stuff like that. They basically have rejected the Monroe Doctrine altogether.
They tried to go communist in a bunch of those, and then we're like, oh, wait a minute, we didn't mean that. you choose whatever you want, just not that one.
And now it's funny because now some Latin American movements are coming back around, like we'll discuss in the Venezuelan border with the Venezuelan border dispute. But there was by the late 1990s, there was a move to like kind of and unilateralism, letting the U.S. speak for them,
mm-hmm,
which, I mean, I get it.
Were we speaking for them a lot?
No, not really anymore.
I wouldn't have thought so.
So historians break up the interpretation of the Monroe Doctrine in the modern era into really four different categories. One is when you have the 50s to the 80s, that's called anti-communist Monroeism.
Okay.
And it was really focused on the USSR and Cuba, and the Monroe Doctrine, or the concepts of the Monroe Doctrine, were really enforced, through coups and intervention and proxy wars. After the fall of the Soviet Union, so like the 90s,
mm-hmm,
something they used this term called quiet enforcement. They were fighting drug trafficking and insurgency groups. Sometimes both at the same time or as one. It was a lot of diplomacy. It was a lot of AIDS, and it was a lot of covert action.
Mm-hmm.
2010s, they called it the strategic revival, is what it gets called. And that was actually going against China, Russia, and Iran's influence in Latin America. So a lot of sanctions and pressure campaigns, you know, specifically focused on countries like Venezuela and Cuba.
Again. Right. Yeah.
And right now we're existing what is sometimes referred to as called the mixed approach. And it's this concept of global multipolarity, which I had to read up a lot of this. I'm usually pretty versed on like an IR and stuff like that, but this is where it gets, like, I think I find it really interesting.
It sounds like you're just grabbing a dice and you're just rolling it and you're randomly selecting one of the previous methods you discussed.
Yeah, it's really, exactly. So it's really like this approach where you let, it's what we're seeing now, where you let these South American nations do what they want. And then you may have adverse rhetoric to them and you may have, you know, diplomatic discussions, but nobody's saying, I mean, outside of like Venezuela and Cuba, there's not really like sanctions against them. Yeah. So what you end up really, you know, seeing in that event is, you're not really seeing us sanction or try and, you know, really get involved with pretty much anything.
No, it's probably just trade deals and things that we allow access to or don't allow access to would probably be my guess.
Exactly. And, you know, not, it's, stop discussing things like the Panama Canal in its modern context. I thought this was really interesting. So before we close this out, and basically over time, we see a rejection of the Monroe Doctrine by pretty much all sitting presidents. It becomes less and less of what it was originally intended to be and more of a justification of, you know, hemispherical dominance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the person who really killed it was Theodore Roosevelt. Sometimes this gets overly simplified as this idea of like Theodore Roosevelt threw away the Monroe Doctrine. Absolutely not. That's not what happened. Right. There was many challenges over, you know, there was just many challenges to it over its entire existence. And it would, but it was Theodore Roosevelt's.
Is that why John Adams didn't claim to have written it?
Right.
It's like, I don't want any piece of this. No, that's all him.
but yeah, it is really cool because it did exist in that kind of state we described it for a long. Again, America was going through, you know, the Civil War. It was going through a lot of the Gilded Age and stuff like that. It was going through a lot of internal self-defining. So it was never really interested. And exactly as Cal said, there was this overwhelming desire for isolationism. It wasn't until Theodore Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt and the Great White Fleet really busted that open. Mm-hmm. And then when international trade became more common, international communication became more common. I mean, never don't count out technology. But I want to talk about something that I always like to highlight things that I learned, like, I had no idea about. And then as I'm doing my research, I learned more about that I personally think is really interesting, but other people might already know about. Kyle, have you ever heard of the Holy Alliance?
Is it like the Holy Trinity?
No. As a Catholic, this will surprise you. As a Catholic, I have heard of the Holy Trinity. the Holy Alliance. It was Russia, Austria, and Prussia. And actually, informally, France never signed on to it, including France, where they just came out of nowhere and they were like, this is in like the mid-1820s. And they were like, we need to put Spain back on the ruling call, the, you know, ruling all its colonies in Latin America. Because the Spanish Empire had collapsed at this point. And
when was this?
Like 1824-ish.
So this is after 1820s. This is after they had basically lost the Spanish fleet in the Napoleonic Wars when they tried to join forces with them about 20 years prior.
Yeah, but is pretty much.
Is this like a sorry we screwed you over so badly in this war? Like, we'll try to make that right now for you?
No, it's yeah. it is wicked funny because basically they got these three nations got together and were like, well, four if you count France, but informally, and they were like, they didn't want to see, you know, this rift of independence start to grow.
Well, yeah, so, anybody who's got a tenuous grasp on power, if you've got somebody else who's showing you there's a better way that doesn't have to be this way, yeah, they're gonna maybe panic a little bit.
So what's funny is, so you have like the Monroe Doctrine comes out like the end of 1823. This like had been kind of forming since the Spanish relative Spanish clouds, but you see like 1824-ish. Remember, it takes time for this to spread.
Yeah.
And, well, Monroe never explicitly says the Holy Alliance. The Holy Alliance was like, wait, what does this mean? And they were kind of like, how do we want to deal with this? Do we want to respond? All that kind of stuff. And the Brits, I don't know, because the Protestant system in Europe's up and running at this point. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but I like to think at some point the Brits were like, hey, we support this. And they were like, really? And they were like, well, how good do you support it? And yeah. a lot of historians will say it was British diplomatic pressure and naval deterrence that stopped those nations. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, they probably still hadn't rebuilt their fleets after Nelson slapped them down.
Yeah, after the British were like, hey, listen, we didn't lose a naval war to the Pilgrims.
Right.
All right. So, does the Monroe Doctrine matter today?
Does it? I'd say it's still getting referenced on occasion. It doesn't happen very frequently, but I still see it pop up every now and then.
What if I told you there was a vote in Venezuela?
I would believe it because you had previously mentioned that about 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
It's also all behind right. me. Right? Something about.
So this is almost a century. This is, well, I should say about 70 years afterwards. There is a very, very famous test of the Venezuelan, of the Monroe Doctrine. It's called the Venezuelan Border Dispute.
Mm-hmm.
And I love talking about this. I've talked about this with kids in my class too, about the importance of history, because Maduro, the president of Venezuela, obviously you have Essequibo, which is Guyana, which used to be French Guyana, modern day Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
The Essequibo region makes up about 80% of the country. It holds unbelievable amounts of oil reserves. It's going to make, I mean, Guyana had GDP growth that destroyed everybody else in the world. It's only, I think it's a country of like 800,000 people. It's not that large of a country.
I didn't know Guyana had that much oil reserves too. Damn.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world. And then Guyana is, you know, obviously geographically located very close. Maduro held a referendum, and the referendum had two questions on it. Basically saying like, should we disregard the decision relative to the Venezuelan border dispute, and if so, should we annex Essequibo? Obviously, because they want the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so, literally, right now there is. I mean, Venezuela mobilized troops and brought them to the border.
Is that why the border lines on this are squiggly lines and not solid? Oh, and I'm looking at it on Google Maps. Yeah.
Can I spell Essequibo?
Good question. You see that?
Oh, my word, yeah.
So, yeah, right there, squiggly instead of solid, like this one here.
That's wild. So it's about 80% of their territory. I think, yeah, that's crazy. Why is it a squiggly line?
I don't know. So,
yeah, so what's funny is that actually Brazil moved troops into that region.
Brazil did?
Yeah, to try and make sure that, you know, Venezuela wouldn't invade.
I guess, yeah, helping out, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Brazil's like the...
Seth.
They try to keep the peace up there. That's not good.
Brazil's the bodyguard down there, yeah.
Right. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so to today, even up to today, that's something that's often referenced when it comes to the Venezuelan, when it comes to the Monroe Doctrine. So in 1895, there was a big territorial conflict between Venezuela and Great Britain over British Guiana and modern-day Guiana. It essentially revived this whole idea of the Monroe Doctrine. Monroe Doctrine, I don't want to say it had been forgotten, but it hadn't been this really, you know, point of challenge in a long time.
Yeah.
But now it's 1895. The U.S. is looking for a fight. It's recovered from the Civil War. It's going through a massive economic expansion because of things like, you know, electricity, effectively. I don't want to sound too, like, right. terse, but, like, electricity.
Railroads, you know, crossing, and interconnecting everything.
Developed this big, powerful economy. And so during the dispute, the United States, directly challenged European power, essentially since the first time the Monroe Doctrine had been written. A lot of historians say this is the first time the Monroe Doctrine was aggressively enforced by the U.S. government,
mm-hmm.
you know, really shifting from that ideological principle to a policy. So to break it up, what was the Venezuela border dispute? You know, it was there's a 30,000 square foot 30,000 square foot area in modern day Essequibo, the area we're talking about. It's called the Essequibo because there's an Essequibo River that runs through it. And it had a ton of gold. I mean, they didn't know. I don't believe they knew they had oil. I mean, oil was only recently discovered in Guyana, maybe about 10 years ago. Started getting mined, probably about 5. And the Great Britain claimed it as part of British Guyana, which had controlled since the early 1880s. Venezuela claimed it based on an older Spanish colonial boundaries, including arguing that Britain had basically gradually taken it over. Nobody really cared about this, to be honest with you. But it wasn't until, like,
Guyana did.
Yeah, right. Well, this discussion had been going along between British Guiana, or the Brits, and Venezuela for a while. But it was in the 1870s, 1880s, they started discovering a bunch of gold, and then they discovered even more gold.
I see El Dorado on here, and I'm looking at this map.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's awesome! So, Venezuela basically had been, this whole time, since 1870s, has been longing for the U.S. to come and support them under Roe Doctrine, but earlier administrations like Grant and those guys didn't want to do it. They just fought a civil war. They don't want to go fight the Brits.
Right.
But in 1895, you know, as these tensions are getting really aggressive, Venezuela formally requested the U.S. to come in and do mediation to figure out who owns it. And Venezuela, I mean, how times have changed, actually called on the U.S. to enforce the Monroe Doctrine. So Grover Cleveland's in office, right? Now, 1895. He sends this guy, Richard Olney, down there. I'm not joking. A lot of historians, I've saw this worded a couple times, strongly worded diplomatic note to Britain. So he goes over to Britain in July 1895. He goes, "Today, the United States is practically sovereign on this continent, and its fiat is law upon the subjects to which it confines in its interposition." Which is crazy. It's basically saying anybody, we are the most powerful nation over here. So even people in other countries are also confined to our laws.
Wow.
Olney's talking to the Brits and he's just like, you know, the Monroe Doctrine is not a warning. It's a threat. Like we right. use this. He says they have the right to investigate, interfere in any European action in South America, or anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. And that includes territorial claim on American republics. This is kind of a cool thing. So basically, there was this idea that you had to be a republic for Monroe to, or you couldn't be a colony or like some sort of like dictatorship or monarchical power.
They wanted you to have some sort of similar system of government, or at least representative of some sort.
Exactly. So, all right. So this all happened in July of 1895. Yeah, on December 17th. By the way, we're now in the part of history where we have like a lot of records.
So yeah.
December 17th, 1895, Grover Cleveland goes to Congress and requests funding for a boundary commission to unilaterally determine the proper border, essentially telling Britain to come fight us. So then Olney goes to the Brits and he's like, "Hey, if you refuse arbitration, we're going to fight you." And this is funny because the Brits wanted the Monroe Doctrine. This was their
chance. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the Brits backed out.
So yeah.
Lord Salisbury, who's the PM at the time, he's basically like, "I don't care." Like, he was like, "I don't care about this." And he got more angry because he thought the U.S. was overstepping their authority.
Right.
But the entire world was like, "Brits, what the, like, what are you doing, dude?" Like, and
stop pissing off America.
Yeah, so they, like, South Africa's in horrible turmoil now too, and Germany, they end up getting in an arms race. This is like the pre-World War One arms race you sometimes hear about with Germany. So they're like, "Oh my god, I don't want to do that." So they ultimately agreed to arbitration in 1897 because they didn't want to risk war with the United States.
It's still 2 years that went by though.
Yeah, the coolest part to me, and I don't know, I think this would make me, if I was a colony that was freeing itself and getting support from the U.S., I thought that'd be kind of cool. So the U.S. actually calls an international tribunal and convenes it in Paris in 1899, and it actually rules in favor of British Guiana. But
oh, really?
And Venezuela received some territory claim, but the Brits retained, you know, most of the gold-rich land. Mm-hmm. But the coolest part is that the principle of arbitration, that the U.S. is going to be the final say, and it was willing to bring military power to do that, but it still chose arbitration and mediation to a lesser extent. Both showed the Monroe Doctrine was enforceable, but also that the U.S. wasn't just going to start sinking ships because it felt like sinking ships.
Right. It was justification, but it wasn't being used for warmongering. It was being used to just try to keep peace in our backyard.
Yeah. And so the U.S., I don't know why I like this so much. At the time, the U.S., like, there was imagery of the time of the U.S. being, like, the guardian of Latin American sovereignty. Yeah. This idea of this, like, champion of defending Latin America. But at the time, Latin America had already started to sour. And they were like, but we still don't trust you, dude. They're like, right. No, we're your guardian and you're going to like it.
Don't look at Mexico.
Yeah. No, that's what they're like. Yeah. We saw that.
I saw Mexico shrink by, like, half a country, right?
Yeah. And then you guys just, like, accepted Texas. It would be like if after the American Civil War, if Mexico just accepted the Confederacy into its nation.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But this would mark the end of of what we consider the traditional Monroe Doctrine. You eventually move through, to the what we started Theodore Roosevelt, which really removed the idea of the Monroe Doctrine to protect republics in Latin America, and is now a justification to intervene in Latin American politics to maintain order. And to this day, that dispute, and that's actually what Maduro's government in Venezuela is challenging, that tribunal ruling in Paris in 1899. So to this day, and they're actually reopening a court case on this, like the International Court is hearing, it looks like they're going to hear cases. I mean, by the time this is out, it's probably going to be more solidified, but they're still hearing cases on it. But that's the Monroe Doctrine. Like,
that's
and it still goes on longer, I kind of wanted to stop at this point to say, like, because now everything after here is, like, just Monroe Doctrine in name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Before we close everything up, we do need to get through those POTUS rankings for Mr. Monroe here.
Let's do it, brother.
All right. So we've got our POTUS scale. It's the same scale we've been using for all of them. This is secretly just going to be a character sheet that we're developing for a free-for-all presidential battle royale that this whole series has just been...
it's all smoke and mirrors. That's actually what we've been doing this time.
The whole reason for this whole thing is just for that. It's going to take 5 years, but man, the payoff will be amazing. So political influence. Tell me about Mr. Monroe's ability to shape political landscapes, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts.
I'm going to only give him a 3 on this.
Yeah, okay. Why is that?
And the reason I'm saying that is because he's very much a product of Madison and Jefferson, that era of good feeling. He didn't dictate that era, and we'll see the era of good feeling almost collapse. Actually, it will collapse at the next election.
Well, it wasn't era of good feelings when he took over either. It was kind of era of good feelings like as he got away from some of those other...
Yeah, I mean, it was already starting to... There's no real opposition. The Federalist Party was dying. But no, I get what you're saying. I would say... Yeah, I'd mostly agree with you on that, actually, Kyle. But I don't think Monroe did any of that.
No.
That's why I would say, like, a 3. Like, not bad. I don't want to be disrespectful, but it's below...
What was his party again?
The Democratic Republican Party.
Okay, so he wasn't with the Federalist.
No. What a long name, by the way. Democratic Republicans. Like, geez, come on, guys.
No wonder why they split in two.
That's not how we got
there. Oh, it's not? Oh. All right, overall governance. Effectiveness of the administration. Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
No, you can finish reading it so everybody knows, but it's 7.
No need. Assessing the effectiveness of the president's administration. You lost. Right there, top cabinet, 7.
7. Absolute 7.
Transformational leadership. The president's capacity to enact significant changes or reforms that alter the course of history.
Oh, 8? 7. the best president?
He might be. Understanding of public needs. How well did this president understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the American public? Did they engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively?
I think he did. I would give him, I honestly want to say 7 again, but a 6 or a 7. He gets a top score for it. I mean, he reduced all the stupid tariffs and everything that were passed by his predecessors. He was cautious in making, investment decisions. He wasn't the biggest infrastructure investor, so that's probably why I would say like a 6, but at the time, nobody was. Even the way he handled the Monroe Doctrine, I think, was fantastic. Yeah, let's give him a 6. I want to see more infrastructure investment.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree with that. Strategic vision, the clarity and ambition of his vision for the country. Do they have a forward-thinking approach that guided their decisions and inspired hope for the future?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I want to say 7. I mean,
Monroe might be the best president.
No, because I look at it and I say, like, you know, he's not the best president by, what's the flashy stuff? He was a quiet man. But you look at what he did, you're just like, you have a hard time being like, what was your bad thing you did?
Right.
Right. And you combine that with the Monroe Doctrine by basically establishing the Western Hemisphere as an independent, autonomous body of European affairs.
Like, and you know what? I'm on Mr. Adams' side on this too. If somebody tells you to write this document, like, he gets some credit for that, because I mean, that is a vision that maybe that credit gets shared, but I think Monroe deserves some of that credit.
I mean, he was the president. He's where the buck stopped. Where the buck started.
All right. Well, I think that probably is where we can wrap things up. So join us next week. We close out the Revolutionary Era with our second president named John Adams. And I don't mean the second president, who was also named John Adams. That could get really confusing there. I think I got Eric's on board to do some recap episodes when we go to celebrate that new era. So if you got any suggestions for that, email them to us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. On your way out, you visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com. You can sub on your favorite platforms to stay up to date with the show, and we will see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.